This is the first time that I'm discussing this very interesting and very disturbing subject. I will start it by telling you about three people. The first one I want to tell you about is Mrs. Murad. She was first arrested with her husband in September of 68. She remains incarcerated in a women's detention camp in Indonesia. She was a teacher of the secondary school at the time. She was also a part-time dressmaker. As far as we can determine, she was arrested because of her husband's political activity and her brother-in-law's political activity, and because she had gone for a time to Lumumba University in Moscow. She had no record of any political association during her time in Indonesia after she returned from Moscow, and she is seriously ill. The second one I want to introduce you to is a person named Mikola. The rest of the name is too difficult to translate or to say correctly.
Why not try it?
Plakhotnik.
Very good. Plakhotnik.
Is that Russian?
Yes. He's a Russian. He's a physician. He graduated with distinction from a medical school and worked in a children's sanatorium and a medical institute. He is detained in a psychiatric hospital in the Ukraine since 1972. He is charged with anti-Soviet agitation and propaganda for distributing Samizdat. Are you familiar with Samizdat? It's a publication, which means self-printed. The people who are concerned with human rights and freedom in Russia, starting after Stalin's death, have been publishing underground a series of materials, and they type them up. Some of it are the Unfinished Symphony, or something by a very famous writer. Solzhenitsyn is a contributor to this, both in word and also in finances. So. And it's sort of an underground thing, and it's passed around. It's also in many other languages. It appears in this country, in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, I guess Hungary, in France, and England. And he was passing this out. And he's now confined to a very inhumane special psychiatric hospital. The third one I'd like to introduce you to is Mr. Lopez. He was arrested from his home by 11 heavily armed plainclothesmen and one woman on 11 December 1975. And he, along with more than 1,500 disappeared persons in Chile since 1975. All efforts by his wife to find him have proved futile. He's a retired furniture carpenter. He has small pension from Social Security. It's the only support for his wife and himself. The wife says, "I do not want to die without knowing what happened to my husband. Is he still alive?" She doesn't know. Now, these aren't household words. These aren't household names. None of you know them. But they are not forgotten by an organization called Amnesty International. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about it and then my limited involvement in it. All of these three people, along with thousands of others, probably over 500,000, are sharing one terrible experience. It's persecution and imprisonment because of their convictions. Their predicament is not an aberration. Today, in more than 100 countries, these 500,000 people are located. And we refer to them in Amnesty International as prisoners of conscience. because they are being punished solely for their race, religion, or their ideas. They are isolated from family and friends, they're locked away in jails and concentration camps, declared insane and consigned to mental institutions, or are banished to remote penal colonies. These prisoners of conscience who have neither used nor advocated violence, and that's a very important point in this. Amnesty International only goes out to free those who have not advocated violence. They are being physically and psychologically degraded or tortured or killed, and their only hope is that someone outside will care enough to do something about their plight. Amnesty International was formed in 1961 in England and the UK. It's a worldwide movement on behalf of prisoners of conscience. It's independent of any government, political faction, ideology, or religious creed. And here's their, why I drew this. This is a candle with a barbed wire around it. And probably to tell you how my involvement in this, we have a tradition in our family that every year, starting with our married life, which was 1942, we add an ornament to our Christmas tree to denote the main activity of the year that is most memorable. The children got into the act as they grew up. There's three little children, babies on the tree, indicating our three children. Susie and her pups are on it, and that was a black lab. That was the year I got my PhD, and I thought it was hands down. I'd have a hood and stuff on it, but I was outvoted 4-1, so Susie and her pups are on it. When I lived with the pigs and raised pigs from birth, there's a whole bunch of pigs on it. But for our purposes here, there's a soldier on it, a combat infantryman, with a 3rd Division patch on it. And I was trained very well for killing. I belonged to an outstanding unit. It was probably, when it went into Africa in assault and into Sicily and into Reserve at Salerno and assault on Anzio, it probably hit the beach as well trained as any unit ever hit any beach. We were exceedingly well equipped and well trained, and I had been in training since before the war started. I was quite proficient in that profession. I was raised in a competitive situation in athletics and other things to the extent that I could contribute. And I was very conscientious in these things. Also on this tree is a piece of barbed wire, and that denotes the 15 months that I was in a prison camp. I made it 5 miles behind the lines on one attack, and I never returned. So I spent 15 months of my life trying to stay alive, but do whatever mischief I could for my captors. You operate in a different way under those circumstances, but you also learn what it is to be incarcerated. It's a very insecure position. I guess that's the background for which I'm addressing this. And you must realize, as a result of this experience, it is difficult for me, it's very difficult for me to be promote nonviolence. Now, how does Amnesty International operate? We operate through letter writing campaigns, publicity campaigns, incidentally, because of its activities, it has caused the release of, since its formation, of probably 13,000 prisoners of conscience throughout the world. And they received the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, in 1977. which is some idea of what they're doing. And many cases, the individual prisoners are released after a very sustained effort on by Amnesty International. Others, of course, benefit by maybe a general amnesty because Amnesty International might be working on the government generally, and then they declare a certain number released, and many of those have occurred, and Amnesty International doesn't flaunt this. They don't take credit for these kind of things because they try to, in anything they can do to cause this release, they do. And we try to make sure that none of these governments forget these things. It's a continual pressure on them to show that the world cares, that injustice, mass arrests, mock trials, tortures, and the death penalty will never become just another news item. And that's why we have a candle of Amnesty International, which symbolizes both hope and illumination. Now, and I mentioned some of the methods that are utilized. The chief office for this is in London, and we have about 100 international secretariats there who pursue news of arrests. They carefully investigate cases of prisoners. They follow political and legal activities over 100 countries. In fact, I think now about 113 countries of every political persuasion. And the research department provides information on prisoners of conscience in 33 countries in detail. That is, in 33 countries, Amnesty International have organized units. But they have an effect on other countries where, of course, you don't have Amnesty International. Amnesty International wouldn't do well in Cambodia, Ethiopia, and Uganda right now, and many other places that I'll tell you about. The government and prison officials in question are then faced with informed, insistent, and continuous appeals. Letters are dispatched to the government ministers, to the embassies, leading newspapers, international organizations, prisoners' relatives, and friends. In critical situations, distinguished jurists or diplomats may be sent to attend controversial trials in these countries or plead for the life of sentenced victim. With more than 100,000 members all over the world, we have been accorded consultative status with the United Nations, the Organization of American States, the Council of Europe, the Organization of African Unity, and as I mentioned, they got the Nobel Peace Prize. I should point out also that we get assignments, and right now my assignment is in Argentina, and I'm now drafting a letter to the president of Argentina about something that's going down there that I will relate to you, and I'll relate some of the other things that go on. Nobody in a given country works in his own country. You go to another country, maybe several of them are focusing on one country. I'll give you a few examples of that. Other people are assigned to the United States. And maybe a Pakistani lawyer might be at the trial here of certain people. Or maybe a Chilean lawyer was here for another trial in this country. And all of this is related in the annual report. I happen to have the 77 Amnesty International report. And here is, by country, their activities in each place. And they double-check all of these things and decide whether these people are prisoners of conscience and whether they're getting a fair shake or not. The so-called, Wilmington 10, for example, are of great concern to these people. The Indian situation in this country, the black situation. They're being monitored by somebody outside of this country as we are monitoring other activities. And in this regard, we have adoption groups. Each adoption group consists of 15 to 25 people. They're assigned up to 3 prisoners in which they contact them. They maybe adopt these people. They always make sure that they check with the family in many of these cases. They may write to the prisoners themselves, offer encouragement. They might provide financial aid for the prisoners' families. And there's also an urgent action network. Members of this special network are called upon to send telegrams or airmail letters to assist prisoners in extreme danger. And we have several of these continuously. There's action groups work on emergency cases requiring immediate attention, where torture or the threat of execution are involved. And there are professional committees organized to write letters. And I'll give you an example of this in the health sciences. And I'll give you a couple of the cases there. And then there are individual activities to meet in locals. In this state, for example, there are many locals. Probably in most of the places from where you're located, there are these activities. And then we contribute a certain amount of money, whatever we can contribute to this. And it may be of interest to you just to give you a little bit about the organization before I proceed any further. And in this regard, you'll be interested to know that there is a board of directors, and I think there's a turnover every 2 years, and they have a chairman of the board. And they also have I think he's a paid executive director. David Hawk was the paid director for the U.S. Section. And he was a theologian out of Union Theological Seminary, training in Oxford. And I won't go into his history because he's out now. I mean, he is resigned, and he has been replaced by a Lutheran. So those of you who are Lutherans will be interested that Gerhard Elston is now the executive director for the U.S. section. He said, "I would also say that while it is natural for religious communities to support their own who are persecuted, judged on the basis of Scripture, they haven't done much when they've supported only their own. Anyone in Jewish or Christian tradition should have a real passion for justice," he said. "Any violation of what is divine in a human person ought to be an immediate and direct concern. Elson's devotion to the cause of human rights has been strongly influenced by his personal history as a German-born Christian of Jewish background. He was a native of Berlin, and at the age of 15 in 1939, he escaped to England." And of course, if he wouldn't have, he'd have been down the tubes, even though he was a third-generation Lutheran in Germany. After World War II, he joined his parents in the United States, and he began pre-medical studies. He dropped out of those while he was in the Army. He discovered that no one knew what the war was about. So he redirected his life to work that he might help prevent the horrors of Nazi Germany from reoccurring. He has since been involved with a great variety of organizations, serving as a staff member for, among others, Lutheran World Federation, the National Council of Churches, Hungarian Refugee Resettlement Program, International Affairs Department, Lutheran Church of America, Center for Ethics and Society. Before joining Amnesty International on July 1st of this year, he was a consultant of various groups and part-time staff member for a project exploring implications of liberation theology for the United States. Among his goals, as Director Elson said, is to work for rapid growth in an AI USA program begun last year to enlist congregations in Inter-Religious Urgent Action Network. Already more than 150 congregations of various denominations have signed up, and a full-time volunteer based on the West Coast is coordinating the network. So do you who are Lutherans understand that there is great concern among them for this? Now, I'm speaking today not as a chairman of the Science and Technology Committee of Holden Village or any affiliation, any official capacity of Holden Village. I'm just informing you, as a member of Amnesty International, to inform you on some very critical matters. And the other thing I wanted to say about it is that kind of a local boy here, a fellow named David Hinckley, is chairman of the board. He's formerly in Seattle. He's a hard charger, age 32 only now. He's been active since he started working as a janitor's assistant at the age of 11, and has been very involved in human rights throughout his, from the age, I suppose, of 11 until 32. And he was the one who also started Matchbox, which is the journal put out by them, which I'll get to after a little while. And I might as well point out now, as others, we try to work in every country, but in Uganda and Ethiopia, We just don't make any contact with any of the prisoners there, because if we do, they're probably down the tubes. It's just too risky for them. We've made a lot of progress in Indonesia, I think, but there's still a ways to go. And I'll have more to say about this as we proceed. Now, one of the great concerns of this, of our enterprise, is to abolish torture. And we could just as well start, I guess, with, well, I'll go into torture. And this is going to shake you up. Otherwise known as better building a better thumbscrew. We have increased our, with great sophistication, our expertise in this regard. It's a very grim science, and that now has its own research facilities, specialists, and schools. Sophistication in Brazil is remarkable. Amnesty International has made a full report on allegations of torture in Brazil. They have very elaborate interrogation rooms there. They have speakers and television of the finest quality that can develop grotesque sound and light shows, reduce the victims to nervous wrecks. They have images of the victim's family that are interspersed with high-speed trains, piercing screams, and strobe lights. It requires a remarkable technical expertise and government coordination. Now, in the old days, you'd pull them apart, stretch them, and run needles down their fingernails and pull out the fingernails, burn them, and all kinds of things like that. And of course, you can pick those out, can't you? You can say, well, this is what happened to those guys. Psychological warfare is pretty hard to figure out. A lot of the techniques, electrical and otherwise, today, and mind-boggling things, you really can't say this is what they've done to them without further study. It's hard to pin down. So strong-arm methods are not always resorted to, because they don't want to leave physical scars, although they do not, they sometimes resort to them, such as with Vera, who was a 27-year-old economics student in Brazil. She was hung up by her legs for 7 hours. She was stripped naked and hung up on a bar. You know, when you hang with your feet from a bar like this, and then you hang down, and then they tied her. It's called the parrot's perch. And then they tied her hands to her ankles. And she was there for 7 hours, and then exposed to also electrical shock, and periodically given drugs to revive her, and then interrogated her. She is paralyzed. Her legs are paralyzed after the torture. Now and then we have a breakthrough. Trying to get evidence in this regard. One of the breakthroughs came a few years ago when Pakistan, we found out, tried to buy special torture equipment from the United States. And the defection of three Uruguayan torturers, they left the country. They were very involved with United States aid for international, or the Agency for International Development, AID. In torture training, and they were shook up because the United States was involved in this. The data comes from doctors who, and lawyers, and students, journalists in various countries on this. Amnesty International checks and double checks. They match affidavits and are able to talk often to torture victims and then get the reports out of the country. AI also gets unsolicited reports, which it double checks with its network, and they often talk to exiles. Often, you see, the victims are made to watch tortures of others, and this way we get corroboration. Brazil right now, in the report that AI produced on Brazil, There were 1,081 people involved in 9 cases that go into gory detail if you want to really get sick. Torture is routine in at least probably over 30 countries today, and it is expanding. There's growing involvement, and this is a real serious concern by doctors, behavioral and psychologists, behavioral scientists, and pharmacists, and technicians, because there's some rather remarkable drugs being developed, and one of the tricky ones is sensory deprivation. You can do some terrible things to people. And if you want to compromise somebody, and the Chinese did this to some of our prisoners in Korea that got in China, all you got to do them is deny them sleep and deny them toilet privileges. Never allow them to take off their clothes, you see. And it isn't long before you go bananas. And they use denial of sleep. All you got to do is keep waking them up. And it isn't long before you go crazy. I know when I was in combat, where you go for long periods without sleep, it's a terrible experience. And when you go through one of these, even a limited exposure I had to this, well, I guess it wasn't limited, but you know, some very difficult times. But still today, I wake up really in horror, middle of the night, you know. Especially, I'll probably do it tonight because I'm talking about it now. And this of course affects him for the rest of her life, far worse than, you know, anything minus a plaything compared to that. In sensory deprivation, one of the things you can do is not only deny sleep. But one of the things they do, where did they do this? Well, I may run across it later on here, so I'll proceed. I want to get back to sensory deprivation. One of the things they use are the drugs. That's what I want to tell you about now. They're still looking. The torture people are still searching for a real good truth serum, because what they want to do is get you break the people. And you get the information from them, confessions. And sodium pentothal, of course, is used as a so-called truth serum. But they've developed a better one, I guess, with our cooperation in Uruguay. And what they do, are some of you familiar with karari? Karari was used by the Indians in their arrows, and karari is not an anesthetic, but it paralyzes you, and it's a terrible thing to watch. Because your muscles, they go into flexion, and it really is very painful, and it's agonizingly painful, and you also you aren't able to breathe, and so what they do is put them on oxygen to keep them alive, and after quite a period of that. They then give them pentothal, and that way they relax into a semi-consciousness and a euphoria, and then they find out they can get they're better candidates for interrogation. And some of this was developed in Uruguay in the military, a hospital in Montevideo, with the assistance of U.S. experts on this. Some of these patients, some of them have gone into suicide and cerebral paralysis. How we know about this is that a Uruguayan physician who was involved in this defected to Chile.
Why would the United States be cooperating with them? Do you know that?
No, it's probably within the military establishment or CIA, I'm not sure. It really shook me up, I'll tell you that.
Why didn't we learn about this through our press?
A little bit of this came out in the press a few years ago, yeah, but not very much. Some of this was in the press. Russia, of course, is very well developed in this area. They commit their dissidents to psychiatric hospitals. And Professor Luntz, he is in the Serbsky Institute of Forensic Psychiatry. He's also a colonel in their secret police. And a lot of times if they have one of these people, like I just mentioned, who might have been passing out the Samizdat, they will have an examination of him, and he, if they declare him normal, he can overrule them. And they use a drug called aminazin, A-M-I-N-A-Z-I-N. It's a crazy drug because it's one of the most terrible things. You just don't feel good anywhere. You feel like laying down. As soon as you lay down, you want to get up, and as soon as you get up, you want to lay down, or you sit down, you want to... It's really terrible. And one of the bad things about this whole thing is that in many cases, some of the medicos are cooperating with the torturers, or they use token doctors and make diagnoses and recommendations, and they might make recommendations never carried out. This has been very well developed in South Africa, for example. Many places they say, well, there's a physician, but the physician will say, that person is suffering acute gastritis due to an ulcer, and you got to get him over there or he'll bleed to death. And he can say that, but they say, well, we don't have any vans, and 3 days later they might take him over. And that's documented. Other doctors may lie. They authorize treatment. They then they go through torture, and then they'll revive the patients and say they can take more. And they can show that the physician said it was all right. Another technique is the mad dentist treatment. It's used in Brazil and many places. What they do is they'll take a drill, and it's a mad dentist, and he'll grind around in the teeth like crazy, break off several teeth. The person may faint. They'll revive them and expose them to electrical shock. In Northern Ireland, I mentioned this, that's where it was, where on this sensory deprivation, they would strip a person down naked in a room, and have them lean, just touching their fingernails against the wall, and they put a hood over them and expose them to terrible noise, continuous noise. Now, some of these noise techniques, it hasn't been fully developed in a lot of places, but you can drive a person bananas with noise on the right cycle, or you can run them all to the restroom. It's a very powerful tool. The Lilly experiments are utilized in some cases, I guess. This was a scientific experiment in Canada, I guess 10 or 20 years ago. And what he did was he had medical students, as I recall, that were volunteers, to find out what would happen to him in sensory deprivation. And they'd put him in soundproof room without any sensory input. Or they'd float him in a tank of tepid water without any noise. You just were submerged in this tepid water. And most people will go bananas in about 4 hours of this. The longest anybody could take it was 10. And you lose cognition. Your cognition deteriorates. You become very anxious. You start hallucinating. They've increased their ability in the old days, you know, they just stick a pin under your fingernails or pull out the fingernails, but now they have electric device they stick under there. That's very effective. In Latin America, Rio de Janeiro, they use the ultraviolet light. They put a person in an ultraviolet room, and it's called a purple room. And of course, if you look at ultraviolet light, you ruin your retina. In Buenos Aires, you've been using a reverberation room where you lay on the couch and you're forced to listen to the tapes of your own torture. And U.S. Special Forces have been working with NATO forces. And when NATO forces exercise, we have a lot of NATO forces exercises. And our own special forces have taught the NATO forces, and I suppose we've exchanged information on how to get information out of prisoners. One of the devices they've developed is the Mitrione vest. You put this vest on and then during interrogation, and you keep pumping up the vest, and you can break the rib cage with it. Now, my assignment in Argentina, as I said, is to, I'm writing a letter now. Now, in Argentina, just in the last few years, 15,000 people have disappeared there, leaving no trace of their whereabouts, and they're disappearing every day. Amnesty International estimates there are 8,000 to 10,000 additional people who have been officially detained as political prisoners. The majority of the prisoners officially detained have not been accused of any crime, have no charges pending against them, and face imprisonment for an indefinite period of time. There is proof that over 25 secret prison camps exist in Argentina, as well as over 20 regular prisons where captives are being brutally tortured. They deprive them of food, drink, and sleep. They have sexual abuse and rape. They remove their teeth, fingernails, and eyes. And it's of a very great concern. And we are requesting a number of things from them, exposing them. Now you'll say, what effect does this have? Well, it has a very serious effect, what people think of somebody, a given nation today, makes a lot of difference. And I'll give you an example of this. In Argentina, Argentina hired one of the best public relations firms in this country. And the first contract, I don't know, it was $1 million or so, I suppose. And they were so happy with the results, they've signed them up for two more contracts. But they're not the only ones. South Africa is spending a pile of money on our agencies here to present a good picture of South Africa. You're being hit with it all the time. I think the Shah of Iran has at least three or four agencies working for him. One of them, as you recall, was Senator Javits's wife, who's worked for the firm for it. Senator Moynihan's brother is in an agency that's selling some of these people. Many of the countries employ these. In Argentina, Burson Marsteller has made an analysis of this. He's the firm that is selling Argentina. And he's told them what they have to do. To get presentable, and he's told them that you gotta knock off, you gotta do something about this terrorist activity, and they've outlined a whole campaign that Argentina must do to become presentable, you might be interested in sort of what this involves. To give them a stable image, and they have a coordinated effort in its various offices throughout the world. They're in eight countries: the United States, Canada, Japan, Great Britain, Belgium, Holland, Mexico, and Colombia. So they're selling Argentina in all these countries, you see, and the approach that they utilized on a long-term effort. They wanted to get at those who influence thinking, which includes the press, government, functionaries, and educators. And also, that's the first one. The second one, to influence the investments, which includes key persons in banks, commercial enterprises, businessmen, and administrative consultants, and then those who influence travel, because they got to get the travel people down there, because you know, where you have a lot of terrorism, people hesitate to go there. And reporters promised to be the hardest to sell, because many of them from the free world, they try to get at the bottom of things. So they aimed their efforts at 53 influential reporters who were involved in editorial. They had editorial responsibilities as to what comes out in the papers, and they developed a basic press package, including the biographies of Argentine government leaders, the local ambassador, and local spokesman in each of these countries. And then they selected with equal care the special people in Argentina who would meet them on a one-to-one basis. They paid their way to Argentina. The editors were furnished beforehand information that all about the people that were coming. And they had very personalized visits, showed them the best of everything. They had receptions in the visitors' home countries with distinguished members of the elite of the country. They had special tours and entertainment. And then they had follow-up back in their own country. Some of them called on these people back in their own country. And they've really done quite a job of telling us that everything is all right in Argentina. And what you see on the television is the result of this. To date, the campaign has been successful from the standpoint, at least, of the public relations people. And as I say, they have gotten two more contracts. How did Burstyn Marsteller address the problems in this dilemma? He said that terrorism and the manner in which Argentina eliminates it are the big problems. And he developed a total of 12 steps that he recommended under the heading of handling of anti-government campaign. Typical is step 2, which urges emphasis on positive factors that terrorism is not the only news from Argentina, nor is it major news. Step 8 solution was to show that the level of violence in Argentina has gone down since the government assumed power. This will require credible proofs, but if such proof is available, it will be extremely useful in counteracting the adverse propaganda campaign. Now, General Videla is not giving his publicist firm much help. He recently redefined his terms, claiming that a terrorist is not just someone with a gun or a bomb, but also someone who spreads ideas that are contrary to Western and Christian civilization. On the other hand, Burstyn Marsteller sympathized with this problem when it noted in his recent summary, "The process of eroding support for the government is being stimulated by an apparently well-financed propaganda campaign internationally sponsored and originating from leftist movements." That, of course, is the sort of public relations loophole through which the right-wing client would love to crawl for comfort. But it is not true, since many left-of-center government and organizations have indeed expressed concern about Argentina's continued campaign of repression, but so has Amnesty International, the Catholic Church, and the U.S. State Department have all said, you know, you're not facing up to these issues. Now, there is such a thing as truth in advertising in this country. If you're going to sell a mouthwash, you got to come to time. But it doesn't apply on selling some of these foreign dictatorships. You can do that with reckless abandon, and it doesn't have anything to do with the truth. And you can make millions of dollars doing it. And this is happening in many countries today. And my great concern, it has to do here with a special concern, is also in the medical end of things, and how I got into this. Jeanetta Sagan was the one that established Amnesty International in this country. She was in the underground in Italy. I think she's an Italian Jew. A fantastic experience in the war. I guess she lost most of her family. And she married Leonard Sagan, who's a physician at Palo Alto. And he has become very interested in the medical ethics and torture, and has recently published an article. This happens to be from the New England Journal of Medicine, in which he makes an appeal to form a group in the medical end of things. Now they have an international organization going that looks just at the health professions and try to laying it on the health professionals, saying, now look at here, you have these responsibilities to take care by oath. It makes no matter where they come from, and also to tell the truth. And I'd like to quote you a little bit from Solzhenitsyn, who is one of a person who I have high regard for and who Muggeridge regards the two greatest people alive today, Malcolm Muggeridge does, Mother Teresa, who I talked a little bit about the other day, and Solzhenitsyn. Certainly he's probably the most courageous person The prison doctor was the interrogator's and executioner's right-hand man. The beaten prisoner would come to on the floor only to hear the doctor's voice. You can continue, the pulse is normal. After a prisoner's 5 days and nights in a punishment cell, the doctor inspects the frozen naked body and says, you can continue. If a prisoner is beaten to death, he signs a death certificate, cirrhosis of the liver or coronary occlusion. And this is what happened to Steve Bilko down in South Africa, you know. Because there was so much pressure that they finally, the truth came out on it. He was beaten many times. He gets an urgent call to a dying prisoner in a cell, and he takes his time. And whoever behaves differently is not kept in the prison as a prison doctor. And then he goes on to say, it is time to think clearly. The incarceration of free-thinking, healthy people in madhouses is spiritual murder. It is a variation of the gas chamber, even more cruel. The torture of the people being killed is more malicious and more prolonged. Like the gas chambers, these crimes will never be forgotten, and those involved in them will be condemned for all time during the life and after death. And this goes on, and it is increasing. And what has happened in the medical community now, or in USSR, on Dr. Glossman, I mentioned Steve Bilko. Dr. Glossman remains imprisoned for refusing to treat as mentally ill dissidents who had been confined to psychiatric hospital. He just says this is wrong. And he's been incarcerated now for many years. And a fellow in Uruguay, Dr. Alonso, he's been in prison without trial since 1972 because he gave medical treatment to a wounded person in. Belong to a different party. So you have this, and what Leonard Sagan and his people are trying to do, and many medicos throughout the world are trying to get experts, and 9 Danish physicians recently, including specialists in neurology, anatomy, psychiatry, surgery, and endocrinology, have carried out projects involving examination of former victims of torture. And they put out this in the evidence of torture. What they're trying to do is scientifically say if they have been exposed to this kind of torture, it is manifested in this way. In physical torture, it's pretty easy to determine, but they're trying to get at the bottom of it. And they also have a dermatological research group who are studying the torture of electrical means to see if there's some changes in the skin that you can detect that says they have been exposed to electrical torture. Another specialist group is working on phalangia. This is a method of torture, and it's kind of hard to prove, and there's some remarkable things that happen from it where they beat the people with a cane or a truncheon on the bottom of their feet. And they also have a forensic group to look at various laws concerning death, and they're trying to establish a common type of death certificate for all people in all countries and for autopsies of those dying that are in custody anywhere in the world. And you see, this would bring them to time, really. And they're also looking at political abuses of psychiatry. And a lot of them, they torture the parents in front of the children. And the effect, of course, on the children is horrendous. And they're studying the effects of that. And they formed an international group just March of this year to establish liaison throughout this. And physicians now are trying to assist in missions to other countries and establishing an urgent network, and on the back of this is a list of some urgent appeals right now from various countries. One of them is of special interest to me because he's a veterinarian in Cameroon. And Idi Amin killed a dean veterinary school in Uganda. Of course, he's killing them right and left. And some of this torture is really terrible, and it'd make you sick, and you won't sleep.
See where Prince Charles, isn't it, of England, was down at a special event in Kenya, and Idi Amin was there, and he came over to introduce himself to Prince Charles, and the prince turned his back on him. And walked away.
Yeah, and that'll probably kill a few more Englishmen in Uganda, you know. It's just, boy, it's terrible. Now they put out a book, or a sort of magazine. It's called The Matchbox. And you say, well, what the world's a matchbox? Does that mean they're out to burn up something? The story on this matchbox was during World War II in the resistance movement, a person who was in the resistance movement was imprisoned. And he was sitting alone in a prison cell, tired, hungry, he was tortured. And he was sure that he was going to die. After weeks of torture and torment, when there was no hope left, and he was sure no one cared, he was awakened in the middle of the night. The door of the cell opened, the jailer was shouting abuse. He threw in a loaf of bread. Now the prisoner, of course, was ravenous, and he tore open the loaf of bread. And inside he found a matchbox. And there was matches and a scrap of paper in it. So the prisoner lit one of the matches, and he looked at the piece of paper, and it said on it, "Coraggio, coraggio, take courage, don't give up, don't give in, we are trying to help you, coraggio." And that's why this is called Matchbox. They also have a release an amnesty action thing, and they'll go through it. And as I say, certain people are assigned certain things, like the group where Dave Hinkle, the present chairman, used to be in Seattle. Well, there are several organizations here within the state of Washington. The one in Seattle, the group there at the University of Washington is concerned now with Guinea. And well, most of you have never heard of Guinea. They're concerned not with all of Guinea in Africa, but they're concerned with Camp Borio, or Boiro. It's B-O-I-R-O, I think it is. It's a terrible, terrible place. Like in one cell alone, they had, I think, 26 prisoners. And one of them, and the confines so tight, you can hardly move. And there's only one source of ventilation. Of course, it's very hot there. And that's a hole in the ceiling. And one person there died from tuberculosis. Over a period of 6 months, 16 of them died. They don't have very much to eat. They throw them a little rice and a little bread. And so many of them have scurvy, beriberi. And on the blacks, they intentionally starve them so they can't, they're too weak to walk. And they use an assortment of torture techniques there. They use electric shocks to the head, the limbs, the genitals, beatings, burn with cigarettes. They hang them from their ankles for long periods of time. They use the submarine treatment. I didn't mention that. You hold them underwater till they go unconscious. And then they also bind them with wire and pull out their fingernails. They use also mental disorientation by deprivation of food and sleep. Prolonged solitary and confinement, and they also humiliate him through stripping and searches. They often, not infrequently, they kick the prisoners to death. Others are tied up in front of the prison and starved to death. And they use this, of course, as a means of impressing upon the citizens of the country that they better shape up. Now, Guinea is a country that signed the Human Rights Declaration of the United Nations. So that's a special concern then this year, and they will put pressure on them and write a lot of letters, probably try to get a visitation team in there. That's the state of it. I'm sorry to bring you, well, I'm not sorry. I think it's important that you know this is going on, that at least it is a concern of yours. And I have here available material that might be, that you can take with you. I only have a few of these, but I have, I think, one for everyone here of the description. Some summarizes what I've said for you. And here are the Amnesty International objectives. And you can read those at your leisure. I mentioned that a big concern are for prisoners of conscience. Now, they are also concerned about people who are in prison, that they get tried and that they have humane treatment. in the prisons, even though they might have been involved in violent action. But as far as any release goes, that's for those who have not been involved in any terrorism. And so that's my presentation, and it'll still give you time. Those of you who want to leave right now, you may go up.
Bill, concerning Amnesty International, what is the official stance or position or attitude of A, the USSR, and B, the United States Authority toward Amnesty International?
Yeah, I don't think there's any official position. Because they're private organizations, and in a lot of places they don't sort of give them the time of day, but they can never accuse them of being associated with any political party, with any terrorist activity, with any resistance using violence. I'm not out in this case to, I mean, wherever I can, I'll say my own country, which is, it tears my heart out when I see some of these things. I know some things like happened in the black community in Philadelphia, some very terrible things. Some of the things we've done to the Indians. But that, for our purposes in Amnesty International, it is not any official thing. We're working on somebody else, and somebody else comes in here. Now, our country does, we're more open, but the only country I couldn't find in there, Norway didn't have anything in there that I could find. Sweden, it was in there. England is in the annual report. I can leave this annual report here if you want, interested in any particular country. I'll just leave this here and I'll pick it up later. You can see what they've said about these various countries for 1977.
Do you maintain any observer or contact with the United Nations?
Yeah, well, we're in a consultative status to the United Nations. Yeah. Yeah.
Neil,
yes.
Do you take a stand on any uprising, like in Nicaragua, for example?
No. No, they don't take any stance. They might report it in the paper here, and you can look over the paper. But we don't take any political stand.
Yes.
No. We're concerned about how these people are treated. Torture is a big issue with Amnesty International, and a big issue anybody that what they go by is the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights, and we say if you guys signed it, you better live up to it.
You just follow that doctrine.
That's right. Yeah. I know we work on a sort of a one-to-one basis and try to impress on them humane treatment. And we don't take sides in any political issue.